Welcome to the post-correction phase of the Planetary Tantra Talks. And with the main Turton, John Lash, in mega high gear as we navigate with the Wisdom Goddess, please let this passage from the Nag Hammadi Codices sink deeply into your consciousness. When Pistis saw the impiety of the Lord Archon, she was filled with anger. Acting in her invisible form, she spoke in this way: "You are mistaken, blind one, false deity who cannot see. There is an immortal, luminous child, the Anthropos, who came into existence before you, and who will appear among your mottled forms. This luminous child will trample you in scorn, just as a potter's clay is pounded into a lump. And you will sink away to your proper zone, the abyss of gravity, along with those who belong to your legion. For at the consummation of your work, the entire defect of archontic illusion, exposed in the light of truth, will be abolished, and that illusion will be as if never had been. On the Origin of the World." Okay, and welcome to Planetary Tantra Talk number 12. It is August the 15th. We are in the middle of a full moon in the lunar cycle of Bhairavi. And I would like to bring John on the line right away so we can get a reading of Shimhamukha to start things out. So, John, I welcome you to Planetary Tantra Talk 12, and that's the 1-2, so we'll give the old 1-2 punch today and really zoom along with some topics.
Thank you, Thomas. It's great to be back. Seems like ages. We'll open with this Sakya ritual prayer to Shimhamukha, who is a lion-faced female Buddha. And she's the equivalent of Bhairavi, who is the current Dakini of this lunar cycle. "Homage to you, Shimhamukha. Your lion face is shocking and black as a storm cloud. You strike terror with your bare teeth shining, tongue lashing, and glare so violent, and you wield a knife and skullcap in the midst of your dance. I praise and revere the one who burns with your fiery wisdom. Wearing dry skulls, snakes, and a tiger's skin around your waist, draped with bone ornaments, with a complete retinue of enlightened females, gleeful executioner of all obstructors and destroyers, I praise and honor the one who holds fast to the fortunate connection with you. Your raging body terrifies the host of detractors. You shout, 'Hum, Fat, kill, destroy.' It terrifies from afar. Your diamond-like mind penetrates ultimate reality. I praise and render homage to you, powerful Dakini." So that's quite a portrait of the Dakini of the month, Bhairavi, whose name means the terrible. And you added a little something to add to that, Thomas, from another recitation devoted to this Dakini.
Yes, let me go ahead and add that on there because I really like the final line of this. It says, "Your nature is spontaneously arising supreme bliss. In order to guide heroes and dakinis, you arise wondrously playing, your mind free from the clouds of conceptual elaboration. You are like a magical illusion that appears but doesn't exist." And the last time we talked, we were mentioning that you had some difficulty kind of keying into her instruction. And that final line there kind of reminded me of that. So I would kind of like to start out today. I have some thoughts about finally connecting into what she's all about, and I would love to hear how you are receiving her instruction these first couple weeks.
Well, thank you, Thomas. As always, it's a pleasure to talk about the Shakti cluster and the fantastic opportunity we have with the Terma of Gaia Awakening. The Terma of Gaia Awakening, which I received in August of 2008, was received during the Bhairavi shift. And I've often reflected on that. The Terma of Gaia Awakening is the invitation of Gaia Sophia herself to the human race. It's her invitation and her sacred instruction to engage in her magic, which is planetary tantra. And each of these dakinis, which are traditionally called tutelary deities in Hindu and Tibetan religion, tutelary deities meaning teaching deities, guides, instructors, each of them has some component of the Sophianic and Gaian wisdom to impart to us. And the way they do so is visceral. It's visceral and it's direct. And it cuts into the mind stream of your inner talk in a most powerful way. And the engagement with this Shaktis month by month and year by year is a learning process. But one catches on very fast. I think you would agree to that. I think you would concur. Other people in our little circle of Shakti practice have also noted this. It catches on very fast. But I must say that there are a couple of Shaktis, a couple of Dakinis in the retinue of Gaia that really have laid me out flat on my back. And their transmission is so powerful that I have hardly been able to articulate it. One of them is Chinnamasta, the self-beheaded Dakini, you know? And the other one is Bhairavi. The intensity of the stream of consciousness, the stream of enlightened bliss consciousness that streams from these Dakinis into our minds is so great that it's very difficult to capture it and retain it. So I've had some difficulty, as you've noted, in really defining the instruction of Bhairavi. So I'm really interested in what your reflections would be on that, because you're well into observation of the Dakini frequencies by now. So tell me what you're getting.
Okay, I'll start out how I'm feeling with this about 2 weeks that I've been experiencing the Bhairavi shift. And you have to remember, the listeners have to remember that, you know, I feel kind of like a four-year-old trying to explain what it'd be like to be dumped in the middle of New York City
with that limited syntax.
And so I'm doing the best I can with what I know. So
hang
in
there.
I was comparing this with the theme of sacred anger compared with like the Matangi that I was feeling in February and March. This was such an overt anger, this anger at the lies and the deceit, that it was very easy for me to communicate this to my family and friends, and of course to you as well. But the anger that I'm feeling with Bhairavi is a much more focused type of an energy that I get this feeling that I could kind of like just call out to Melchizedek and say, you know, show up in front of me right now, and I could just feel like I could just kick his butt and show him what a real, you know, member of the Anthropos could do. That's just the feeling I'm getting now. It's a very focused hum of anger. It's not this wild stuff that I was feeling with Matangi. So that's how I can phrase it in my limited syntax right now.
Well, it's beautiful, Thomas. And it brings to mind for me an analogy of the samurai sword. You would know well because you live there in Japan. And some people may know this. That sword making is a great, great high art in Japan, and it relates also to the shamanic tradition, because originally sword makers and shamans were the same. Forging of metals was a shamanic art, always in many cultures. And as you know, the samurai swords are so sharp that if you lay one down with its edge up and you drop a Kleenex on it from 10 feet, it will cut the Kleenex. That's how sharp they are.
That's right.
And how do they get to be that sharp? Because they are pounded and melted upwards of 30,000 times. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In other words, the swordsman, the swords maker, gets the metal, chooses the metal, puts the metal in the fire, heats the metal, and then pounds the metal, then puts it in the water and tempers it, folds it, pounds it again, and it can be folded and pounded up to 30,000 times to become the hardest, sharpest edge in the world. And that is a perfect analogy to sacred anger. You know, anger is not something that you want to use carelessly. Anger is something that you want to use with impeccability and compassion, but also with absolute brutal detachment if necessary. And the moment is coming when that sort of anger is needed, is really, really needed. Because as this whole pestilence of deceit and murderous lies and deceptions of our society breaks open, the force of sacred anger is going to be tremendously important. And this is what Bhairavi teaches. This is what Sima Mukha teaches. And so she takes you like a blade, and she folds you and heats you and pounds you and tempers you. And that's what she does to you. And when she's doing it, it doesn't necessarily feel so nice.
Interesting. I can really relate to that, yeah.
As a matter of fact, I was talking with my friend Kundri yesterday. We were standing on the navigation deck under the stars, and I was saying, you know, this Bhairavi shift, it's wicked, man. I mean, I've never been able to handle Bhairavi. I can't get the point of what she's doing. But I can only tell you what it feels like. The word is evisceration, you know. It's like a sweet, tender evisceration. And it's like a tempering of the deepest metal that you have in your own guts, you know. Do you have the guts? This is a question I want to ask everyone who's following my talks now with you and is following this fantastic mythical experiment with Gaia. I want to ask you, do you have the guts to look naked in the face of human evil? Well, it takes a lot of guts. And when you can look at that and you can bring the force of sacred anger to that, then you are a warrior in the band of Gaia. And you're in the avant-garde. And we're going ahead with this because it's the only way that our species is going to make it.
Fantastic. Yeah, who has the guts? Who's got, and that guts ties into the Kundalini arising that a lot of people are probably feeling with the perigee surge.
I would think so. I'm getting notes from people, you know. These surges are not necessarily, they're not necessarily going to feel them immediately and dramatically because they're subliminal. You have to come to understand and study very closely what the nature of the subliminal is. In Tantra, we work with the subliminal, and we bring it into consciousness. That is the difference between the sorcerer, the warrior, and the shaman, and the ordinary person. The ordinary person is manipulated by the powers in their own subliminal mind. They're subliminally directed. But the shaman, the sorcerer, and the warrior bring the subliminal into conscious intention. And this is what we're doing, and this is a very, very intense practice, which is especially acute during this Bhairavi shift. So we're kind of mixing up here, Thomas, a little bit, the language of planetary tantra and the Dakini shifts with our larger subject here, aren't we? Our larger subject being the orientation to correction.
That's true.
But they do mix together. And those of you who are not yet familiar with the Dakini cycles can go to Planetary Tantra and brush up on this. But basically what we're saying is that during each lunar month, the moon, which is not an artificial satellite put in place by ETs, by the way, the moon, which is a biofeedback device of the Gaian matrix, will show you what frequencies to tune into each month to optimize your connection to the planetary animal mother and to Sophia. And so the optimal connection this month is to Bharavi, who's setting us up for the very powerful events in correction, which are looming directly ahead of us.
Very interesting. I would like to go on with a couple more points here before we kind of get into the meat of tonight's talk.
Sure.
One is, last time you were talking about with the kundalini that comes in with the through the sacral plexus, through the sacrum area, that with that kundalini arising, that you could really just decimate an archon or an archontic influence with, you know, a wave of your hand. And I find it very interesting that in Japanese, the sacrum is called the senkotsu, which is, the sen is the same as in sendai, which means sacred. It's the sacred bone, the sacrum is. And it's kind of interesting that Sendai is also the place that received the big hit there with the tsunamis. So anyway, I just want to put that out as kind of a footnote there. Now, a little bit more of a big topic I want to run by you. And if you want to, you can dismiss this because it might be too abstract, but I'm going to mention this anyway. These purge hits that we've had, six or perhaps seven of so far, remind me a lot of Krishnamurti's thing that he called the process. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with that part of Krishnamurti's life or not.
No, not exactly.
Well, he was groomed by the Theosophy Society to be the next Messiah.
Indeed, he was groomed to be the Maitreya.
That's right, the Buddha. The Maitreya. And he later, you know, rejected all that when he was 26.
Totally.
But there's a great book out there called The Inner Life of Krishnamurti, and it documents very detailed, in a very detailed manner, about how he was being his head chakra, and the kundalini forces were being opened up by forces outside of him. That you can put those in whatever framework and whatever syntax you want, but it goes into very great detail about that. And the reason I'm bringing that up is because I'm wondering if this is kind of what VV is doing to mankind, or at least the ones that are tuned into this. She's kind of opening up certain sections of our psyche, of our neural connections. And I was just wondering is that kind of what's going on? It's kind of a rewiring that's going on in a sense.
Well, to put it mildly, rewiring. You could call it a blasting, you know.
She's blasting.
Yeah. She's blasting her way. She is flirtatious lightning. And when you are in the current of flirtatious lightning, you know what that is. This is not just a name.
Mm-hmm.
She's blasting her way through our neuronal circuits. And those who can stand it will end up in her company and end up in her magic. It's not like, you know, it's not like everybody will be able to stand that level of intensity. But that's what she offers. And that's where the beauty and that's where the freedom are to be found. And I love you bringing up Krishnamurti, by the way. Krishnamurti was the original anti-guru, you know. He refused to be a guru.
Right.
By the way, I saw Krishnamurti. I saw him. I was in his presence. I sat with Krishnamurti when I was 19 years old. Outside
that's
the wall.
That's funny. I sat with him when I was 18 years old.
Did
that's
you really?
Very funny. 1982, yeah.
We're connected. And it's amazing we're connected in that way because he's an extraordinary being. And yet he was no longer allowed in Ajar, which is the Theosophical Society in Madras, India, in the grounds of the society after he rejected his role as a Maitreya. He refused to be a Messiah. So he used to come and sit outside the walls of Ajar and give talks. And I attended one of those talks. So he was like the ultimate anti-guru. He's probably the only anti-guru that we really need. because he put us back into self-reliance. And his life is very, very much worth a study, because it's extremely revealing about the Luciferic and New Age delusions of our time, you know. And he broke through there, and he was also, in some way, I would say, an instrument of some kind of Dakini power. He was an instrument of the Shakti cluster in some fashion. The Shakti cluster comes into your mind like a thunderstorm, and it tears away in beautiful displays of lightning. It tears away everything that separates you from the divine beauty and wisdom of the presence of Sophia, because her presence is the only irrefutable truth we have. And so he was someone who was a forerunner of that experience, and I really respect him in that regard. And his life is a very interesting parallel on the path to Sophianic magic. So I'm really glad you bring Krishnamurti up.
That's interesting. That take on it is exactly how I'd felt about it after I reread this book that I had read a few years ago. It does seem like he was being played with by the Shakti cluster, but it just wasn't obviously in his mind put into those words. But that does make perfect sense.
That's right. Yes, indeed.
Very interesting. Now, I want to add one more thing about Bhairavi before we jump into the main topic here.
Sure.
You had mentioned in the one of the recent crew notes that you and your friend Kundri there had seen flashes of light and incredible rumblings that extended for quite some time, a few nights back. And this happened to me just last night with my family. We went out for dinner, and coming back, the whole night sky was being lit up like flash bulbs all over the place. And when we got back home, we were hearing these rumblings outside that it wasn't thunder. And I was looking at my 17-year-old boy, Miguel, and we were giving each other looks like, you know, this is really unusual. It felt like a 20-second growling of, you know, the planetary animal mother in a sense. Very, very amazing thing. It really felt like a grumbling or a rumbling, yeah, that way.
Well, the planetary animal mother, or PAM for short, is to be conceived imaginatively, to be visualized as a lion. She does growl. You know, I'm going to post a link. I'm going to post a little note to the crew of the mothership on an interesting site that lists around the world now the extraordinary number of anomalous events of rumblings and growlings from the earth. I mean, they can't describe it in any other way. This is literally what it is. The planetary animal mother is waking up. Her animal powers are discharging into the human psyche. And as we are experiencing this, even without knowing what it is, many people are experiencing this, and they're describing it as these growlings and rumblings in the sky and in the earth. And there's a site I'm going to link to that that actually lists these, and there are dozens of them. It's extraordinary.
Fantastic. I look forward to seeing that. And so you were experiencing that same thing then. You were hearing an actual kind of almost a growling, if I read your report correctly.
Yeah, we're out there at night, 2, 3, 4 in the morning. I mean, Andalusian skies are absolutely pristine. There's no more beautiful place to observe the constellations, and it's extremely quiet here. There's no electrical noise, and in that ideal environment where the electrical and mechanical noises are at a minimum, you start to really hear the noises that the earth herself is making.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. Well, good. I look forward to reading up more about that. That's fantastic. Well, John, let's go ahead and go into now where we kind of left off last time, and you'd kind of nudged me to pick it up that way. So let's see, where we were talking about the chiral lock.
Right.
And you're saying in the framework of Gaian eco-sorcery, that you could explain how the archontic powers kind of capture the human mind.
That's right.
And then behind the archon plexus, that you're talking about the first bolt, the shattered or dissolved lock, and you're talking about a way to an exercise to keep that supple and to keep it sliding in a more efficacious manner. So if you'd like to continue with that thread, I would love to hear more about this.
Sure. Here we go right to the core of a technique of Gaian Echo Sorcery. And this is exactly the moment to disclose this technique and to present a very simple methods of working this technique. First, I want to say that this term, chiral lock, is extremely important. You can call it chiral or chiral. C-H-I-R-O-S is the Greek word for hand. So the chiral lock means the lock of handedness, the lock of right-left. And the lock of right-left is a very deep, deep secret of the fractal structure of the universe. As Louis Pasteur himself understood, there's a very amazing event that happened in the life of Louis Pasteur, who was in many ways a jerk and unfortunately introduced us to some very deceptive ideas. But he did have a moment of illumination in his life that was very remarkable, whereas he was studying crystal structures under a microscope. This was before he came out with all this ridiculous ideas of viral infection that he was known for. This was the real revelation of Louis Pasteur. And you can read about this in a book by a certain person who wrote about chirality. I can't think of his name right now. So anyway, Louis Pasteur, in his early apprentice years, was studying crystalline structures under a microscope. And he noted that they were all handed and that they tended to be left-handed. The nature of crystalline and organic structures in Gaian symbiosis has a left-handed bias, a feminine bias. And he observed that by looking through a telescope, looking through a microscope. And he was so excited at one moment that he thought that he had discovered the secret of nature in chirality or handedness. And he got so excited that he ran out into the hallway of the laboratory that he was in and started to take off all his clothes. This is how excited he was.
Really?
We know how that feels, don't we? And so he said, I've discovered it. I've discovered the secret of the universe. And the secret of the universe is in chirality, handedness. So what happened on March 19th, when Sophia made her first strike into human consciousness to lead us into correction, is that she broke the chiral lock. The chiral lock is what the archons count on. The archons, in fact, create the chiral lock. You see, we have two ways of knowing the universe and knowing ourselves. One is through reason, and the other is through imagination. And in the way that our species is designed, in the way that it was originally conceived and engineered by Sophia herself in the Pleuromic Center, is that there is a play back and forth. There's a complementation between reason and imagination. Reason, the linear logic method of the first attention, can show us many things, but it cannot show us everything. Imagination, the fluidic, playful, explorative faculty of the second attention, can show us many things, but it cannot show us everything. But the combination of the two can show us everything. And the Gnostics were called smart asses and know-it-alls because they knew how to combine the two. And they knew everything. Everything that can be knowable, that is. They knew it. And so we are now regaining this faculty. because Sophia broke the rigid lock that had been induced between the right side, which is dreaming, and the left side, the left eye, the right eye, which is dreaming, and the left eye, which is linear attention. And then she did this in her first blow, her first strike on us on March 19th, 2011. So, we talked about this before in our previous interview, right, Thomas? And I said something about how I described it as two plates, right, that float over each other. So go back over that with me so I can pick it up at the right point.
Okay, well, you're saying that the two plates that were kind of, in a sense, melded into each other through this archontic lock, through the chiral lock, and then when that was broken open, what that did is allowed us, of course, more freedom, but the way I gathered is that since we are not used to dealing with that, we kind of lost the ability to concentrate, hard to hold on to one task for very long. But we are now, with this release, we actually have more freedom. We can work with these two energies or these two perceptions in a much more effective way.
Good. That's very helpful. Okay. At first, we're going to feel at a kind of disadvantage. Since March 19th and probably into September, beginning of October, there's kind of a disorientation that is caused by Sophia breaking this lock. See, we're not used to having the lock fluid. We're not used to having the first attention and the second attention fluid. We're used to having them locked. And so once she makes them fluid, she allows the two attentions to flow into each other and to interact. And they're like two plates. Imagine that you are wearing two huge lenses of sunglasses. And the lens over your right eye and the lens over your left eye are like two huge peripheral lenses. And they, in the right, correct dynamic, those two lenses should float freely over each other.
Mm-hmm.
That means that the linear first attention of reasoning should cooperate and complement with the non-linear second attention of dreaming and imagination. And so when she breaks the lock, the first thing that we experience is, first of all, neither our first attention nor our second attention work as they used to anymore. In our first attention, we find that we can't concentrate anymore. You may have found over the last few months that you just can't concentrate on certain things. You can't, like I've noticed, I can't read. And I was talking to Kundry about this. It's like we can't read. We can't do things that are, except they're the most elementary things, like simple tasks that you can do, like house cleaning or ritual tasks. You can occupy the first attention. But in a certain way, the ability to concentrate in a linear way has been interrupted. At the same time, there's a sense of kind of free-floating, vague reverie, daydreaming. I just want to dream. Just leave me alone. I just want to kind of float and dream in an aimless way. That's because the second attention has been freed. So the first and second attention have been freed by the jolt of Sophia on March 19th. And what we're going to do now is gradually learn to coordinate them. But the key is to keep them fluid. So I'm going to tell you right now what freezes the first and second attention into a lock, what locks them on a scene, and what you can do to keep them from relocking. Okay?
Good. Yeah. So first, what locks them? Yeah. What is the what function does that, or what is the mechanism of that?
That comes from outside. That shortens your attention span. That is to say, advertising.
Mm-hmm.
What's called jackhammer editing in MTV. You notice if you look at an advertisement, an advertisement for a car may only last 30 seconds. But in that 30 seconds, there will be 50 cuts. 50 edits. So in fact, what is the advertisement doing to you? No matter what its content is, it doesn't matter if it's an advertisement for pineapples or Toyotas. What is it doing to you? The advertisement, which is a technological device working on your consciousness, is forcing you to bring down your attention span to less than a second. The only way you can follow it is by following the cuts, and the cuts are less than a second. It also happens in a movie now. Go back and rent a movie. Go back and rent The Big Sleep with Bogart and Bacall. Absolutely fantastic movie. And do what I do as a filmmaker and somebody who writes film screens of screenplays. I count the shots. A shot is how long a director keeps the camera on a particular action. If you go back and you count the shots in The Big Sleep, which, by the way, is a fantastically good movie, you'll find that there are very long shots. Okay? Very long shots. The camera stays on a scene for a long time. If, however, you come forward and you rent a movie like a James Bond movie, a recent James Bond movie, like Quantum of Solace, you know, and count the shots, there's hardly a shot that lasts more than 2 seconds.
Yeah.
See the difference?
I was literally jumping up and down watching Kagemusha, one of the great Kurosawa movies.
Right.
And the opening scene of that, it's literally 10 minutes with the camera just left in one angle, one frame size with three actors, and not even a lot of speaking in there going on. And I was just exclaiming to my wife, you know, this is amazing work. This is incredible. She couldn't catch why I was so excited about it. But yeah.
Cinema is
vastly different than what we're getting now.
Totally. Cinema is a great education in how the archonic powers work to reduce our power of attention to less than a second. Everything that reduces your power of attention to less, everything that demands less than 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 seconds of attention. Tweeting. Don't tweet. Don't watch advertisements. Don't watch television. Don't tune in to anything in the external environment that reduces your attention to less than 5 seconds, because then you are being thrown back into the chiral lock. The objective of the archons is to freeze the first and second attention along a rigid seam. They don't float over each other anymore. Reason and imagination do not interact. They are rigidly separated along this seam, and that is the chiral lock. So once you understand that phenomena, you can be wary of a great many things that are happening in the external world, and you can be armed, mentally and psychologically armed, against the depredations and invasions of the archons into your mind through the electronic media. Is that clear?
That is very clear. Now, is that the only way that is done, or are there other aspects?
That's the main way that it's done. Everything that reduces your attention span and requires less attention freezes the chiral lock. Everything that requires more attention eases the chiral lock. So we know now that there's been a supernatural intervention from the goddess of fire, has broken open and shattered the chiral lock. That means that in the near future, our ability to combine reason and imagination is going to become tremendously amplified, and we're going to be able to reach levels of consciousness that we have never reached before. And my aim in the Gaia Navigation Experiment is to direct you toward those levels of consciousness. But in that aim, I would like to offer a very simple experiment for keeping the chiral lock open and not allowing it to freeze.
Great. I'm very excited to hear this.
The way you do that is very simple. You stick out your hand with your thumb upright, like a painter. Extend your arm with your thumb upright and line your thumb to some vertical surface in your environment, like the edge of a door or the edge of a window or the edge of a picture. Align your thumb to a vertical surface. Then close one eye and see what happens. Open that eye, close the other eye and see what happens. And when you align your thumb, which is held at arm's length, to a vertical line, you use both eyes. Then you close one eye and the other alternatively, and you see what happens. And you'll notice a difference. In my case, for instance, it works like this. When the when I close my right eye, there's no change. The thumb remains exactly where it was, lined up to the edge of the door. When I close my
That's what happens with myself as well. Yeah.
When I close my left eye, what happens?
It moves to the
left.
It moves to the left.
Right. When you close your left eye, the thumb jumps to the left, and it's no longer in front of the line that you've aligned it with, but it's several inches to the left. And in some people, that will occur in the other direction. It will jump to the right. It doesn't matter if it jumps to the right or the left. This is the exercise. Line your thumb to a vertical line. Find out which eye causes the thumb to jump, either to the right or the left. And open and close that eye continually. In other words, blink. Blink so that your thumb jumps back and forth. Back and forth, back and forth. And do this for a minute or two until you get kind of a feeling of the motion that your thumb is jumping back and forth. Then stop for a minute, pause, and then again, use both eyes to look at your thumb, align it to the line, and just look at your thumb now, not blinking, and notice how to one side of the other of your thumb, another thumb will appear. And suddenly, you'll be seeing two thumbs. Can you do that? You'll see two thumbs.
I'm doing that as I'm listening to you.
Yeah, you see two thumbs. Okay, this is the trick. When you see two thumbs, it means that the chiral lock is open. It's not locked. And so what you then do is just very relaxedly, you never stare and you never look hard. You always look in a relaxed way. You look at the two thumbs until you see the two thumbs. It's very stable. You're seeing something that's not natural, but it's real. You're seeing an illusion, but the illusion is real. You're seeing your actual thumb aligned to the vertical line, which is a doorway, and then you're seeing the other thumb to the right or left of it. Hold that vision of the two thumbs steady until you get it steady. And then when it's steady, slowly shift your gaze in between the two thumbs. It's as if the two thumbs are like a sight on a gun. Understand that? You know what a sight on a gun looks like? It's just a groove. And so what you want to do now, in the last stage of this exercise, to keep the chiral lock fluid and open, is that you slowly shift your gaze to the sight line between the two thumbs. Because it's in the sight line between the two thumbs that the chiral lock is open. If it fixes on the thumb that is aligned to the door, or if it fixes on the thumb that is to the right or left, it's locked. But if you can hold your sight between the two thumbs, then it's fluid. And this is a very simple exercise. You can do it for 3 or 4 minutes a day, and it will keep the chiral lock fluid and open.
That's fascinating. That's going to take a couple listens to get it down perfectly, but that's very valuable information. That's something I will do myself and encourage people to play with this. Fantastic.
So
it's kind of interesting, too, that let me just add one part there.
Sure.
It kind of ties into a theme that keeps popping up here in the talks recently, like the apogee, perigee, divine alchemy, divine memory. This, you know, jumping back and forth between two similar but differing polarities.
Well, yeah, there's always that theme.
But it just kind of brings up a theme in my mind.
Yeah, you know, it's to realize that basic teaching of Tantra is different of what is called Bahavada Tantricism. It's different from Advaita. You know, Advaita teaching, which is a profound metaphysics of the Orient, is very, very popular to people because the Veda teaches unity. It teaches that everything is that basis, a unity. But Tantra is actually way, way beyond that and far more interesting, in my view. Because Mayavada Vedanta teaches that the nature of reality is dyadic and relational. And so everything deals with duality. Duality is really interesting. Unity is a fucking bore, you know? You can go back to you can go back to unity anytime you want. And where do you get? Nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even the divine powers get bored with unity. You know?
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing is not unity, but union. Union. What is union? Union is the relation of different things. And so in Mayavada Vedanta, which is very, very key metaphysical paradigm of planetary tantra, we deal always with polarity, dyadic structures, dyadic functions, and relational, the relational dynamics of divinity. This is what's really, really interesting. Rather than the static nature of divinity, which is a mere unity, you know. And so there's so much to learn from these dyadic practices and techniques.
Very interesting. Yeah, I studied Advaita for many, many years, and you do come into kind of a dead end. It's a blissful state in a sense, but there's just nothing happening. And yeah, this is much more dynamic, much more exciting.
Yeah, I would say this about Advaita Vedanta. It's where you come from, absolutely. But you can't go anywhere with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just where you come from.
Indeed. Indeed. And it took me a long time to grasp the difference between unity and union when you pointed that out a few months ago. But I believe I have a good grasp on that now. And I thank you for pointing out the vast difference there.
Well, you're very welcome, my friend. And it's one of the most wonderful realizations of my own life. And I'm very happy to share it with people when it's appropriate.
So, John, let's go on to the next related subject, which is the Archon Plexus, which, of course, we also talked about last time, and the stare at the back of the neck, the cold chill that comes up with the spinal fluid.
Right. Did I say that?
The adrenochrome. And you wanted to expand on that.
I actually said that already.
What?
Oh, well.
What's that?
I'm amazed that I said that already. Okay, I'll expand on that. Be most happy to.
Please.
This is what you want to say about fucking archons, you know? They get you coming and going.
Mm-hmm.
They get you coming because they get you in the chiral lock right between your eyes. And they get you going because they get you behind the neck. So there are actually two physicodynamic, psychodynamic points of access that the archons have into human consciousness. And I want to emphasize, and this has never been said before by anyone on this planet, these points of access that the archons have are actually gestural and physical postures. Please take that on board. And if they are gestural and physical postures, that they can be overcome by gestural and physical postures.
With kind of an antidotal type of a gesture, huh?
Exactly. So I just explained the gestural, physical, ritual technique, the Mickey Mouse technique of looking at your own thumb and blinking your eyes. If the archons are Mickey Mouse, this is what you got to get. they're fucking Mickey Mouse tricksters and intruders. And the way that you overcome them is with Mickey Mouse magic.
Mickey Mouse magic, okay.
That's right. In other words, it's not something that you have to go to some occult school of metaphysics for 20 years to learn. I can teach it to you in 5 New York minutes. Besides, we don't have time. You understand? We don't have time.
Mm-hmm. We don't have 10 years to sit on a mountaintop, yeah.
That's right. We don't have time for 20 years a month. I have to show you. I'm not a shaman. I'm not a telestic Gaian shaman if I can't show you in 5 New York minutes how to beat the archons. So, you beat them as they come toward you with this simple exercise of keeping the chiral lock open. Now, what do you do about the back of your neck? Because they grab you at the back of your neck. Let me give you this visualization. The Archons are this locust-like cyborg species that inhabits the solar system at large. They do not breathe. Mark that, my friends. They do not breathe. And they have a silicon mercury based organism. They are archonic drones who can only do what they're told and what they're programmed to do. They are very robotic and they are extremely bored.
They're extremely bored.
Yeah, that's right. The archons are bored. And that, in fact, is what makes them so dangerous. Because, you know, bored people can do very bad things to other people who are occupied with good things. They can really mess with people and meddle with people who are doing things who are not bored. And we should not be bored because we're engaged with Sophia. We're engaged with each other in play, in divine imagination, in the divine experiment on this planet, in pleasure. And we're not bored. But they're very, very bored. So they're out there in the realms of the solar system. They can't invade the Earth. They can't live here because oxygen is toxic to them. Nitrogen scares the living bejesus out of them. And they just can't adapt to our environment, but they would like to wreck it because they're so envious of us, as the Gnostics warned. So what do they do with their spare time? And believe me, they've got a lot of spare time. Well, they do exactly what these goddamn Majestic 12 CIA-funded remote-controlling teams did in the 70s and 80s before that project was canceled. They do
they remote view on you.
And in fact, the CIA remote viewing experiments that are reported by Monagle and other people like that who participated in them, which were set up by very deviant and sick people like Andrea Puharic, you know, mind control freaks and people who want to fuck
and the group of nine or whatever they're called,
all of those people, you know, those experiments were in a way just sort of like archontic simulations, you know. They were sort of like caricatures, human beings imitating what the archons do. The archons sit out there in the rings of Saturn, which is where their main zone of habitation, and they gather up in teams and remote view human beings. Now, there are billions and billions of archons compared to us. So there could be a team of 50 or 100 archons remote viewing you alone. And what they do is they concentrate on the back of your neck. Now, it's known. You know, do you know about Rupert Sheldrake's experiments with staring at the back of a person's neck?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Go research that on the internet. Extremely interesting. There's something about human beings, there's something about our animal and psychic ability that we know when somebody's staring at the back of our neck. And this is a very good thing. Because I'm telling you right now that there's a team of archons staring at the back of your neck as I speak.
Boy, that sent a little chill up my spine there.
And this is what they do, and they induce an effect in the amygdala and in the arc complex of the human brain. Now, in and of itself, the reptilian brain and the arc complex of the human brain, or the arc complex, if you want to make a pun, is not harmful and is an important part of our stable evolution. It's the part of us that is defensive, the fight or flight. And we need that. We need to recognize we're in physical danger. There are predators in the world. And so there's nothing essentially evil or wrong with the R complex or reptilian brain complex of humanity. It's a part of our genetic and phylogenetic evolution. These archons seize upon the physiochemistry of the reptilian complex of the human brain by staring into it. That's how they get access to us from behind. And the consequence of that is twofold, my friends. The first consequence of that is that we become inordinately and exaggeratedly prone to fear. We become paranoid. It makes us paranoid.
That makes sense, yeah.
The second aspect of it is, and this is very, very bizarre, and I would have to go into excruciating arcane technicalities of telestic shamanism to make any sense of this at all. They induce into our physiological system the power of gravitation, and specifically the power of the acceleration by gravity. Tried to point this out. This is a very, very technical point of planetary dynamics. The power of the acceleration by gravity is 32 feet per second per second. Now, this supposedly is a cosmic law in our world, but it's really not a cosmic law at all. It's an archontic structure. It's an archontic illusion that is enforced upon us because we live in the archontic paradigm. As long as we live in the archontic paradigm and we do not interact directly with the divine, vibrant, pleasure-filled, ecstatic, bliss-filled, wisdom-filled matrix of the planet, then we're in the archonic paradigm. The archonic paradigm is physics, Einstein, Bohr, relativity, atomic theory, Newtonian physics, all of this. This is all the archonic paradigm. As long as we live in the archontic paradigm of science, we don't live in connection with the divine life force of the goddess. And when we live in this archonic paradigm, it's not just a matter of being captured by an attitude. It's actually we are physically captured in it. Physically. We are physically captured in the force of the acceleration of gravity of 32 feet per second per second. The result of that is sort of like this. There's an archon behind you. There's a team of archons, and they're staring down the back of your neck. And what they do is they cause a change in the level of the spinal fluid in your spinal column. Because of the pressure that they exert, which is quantitatively measurable in the acceleration of gravity at 32 feet per second per second, because of the pressure they exert by their archontic stare, they raise the level of the spinal fluid in your spinal column. and they make you feel fear and cold, and they turn you into an archonic freak, either someone who is a perpetrator or someone who is already victim of the perpetrators. This is their most insidious strategy. And this is a physical and psychophysical and psychological and physiochemical reality, folks. You cannot escape it. It is due to the fact that the Earth, for now, not for long, but for now, and for a long time, has been captured in an archontic system of inorganic physics. I still hear Thomas.
Yes, well, you've left me speechless. I'm grasping what you're saying very well. It's just the immensity of what you've just said is kind of overwhelming me at the moment. That's amazing.
Well, you don't have, it is amazing. It's amazing information. And it's not information, my friends. You know, this ain't information. You never get information from the main turn. What you get is sacred instruction. And the reason why it stuns you and stops you in your tracks, the difference is you can take information or leave it, but you cannot take in sacred instruction or leave it. You take it or it leaves you. Do you get that? You take it or it leaves you.
Yes.
Okay? So if you get this sacred instruction that I'm transmitting, you have got to apply it. You have got to realize the urgency and the absolute imperative nature of this information, which is not just information. So what I'm going to do now, because we're coming up on 60 minutes here, and we only have like an hour and 6 minutes on the recording.
Yes.
I'll tell you how to deal with it, okay?
Okay, great.
This is a trick. Imagine that you're swimming in a swimming pool. And you're just swimming along. Maybe you're just doing the dog paddle. You're just staying in one place and you're doing the dog paddle, not necessarily going anywhere. And someone comes along and they're on a rubber raft. They're on a rubber thing. So they've got a little advantage over you. They're kind of floating along. And they come along and they float up beside you and they push you down. They push you down. They put their hands on their shoulders and they push you down in the water. And they're going to drown you. They're going to drown you by pushing you down. This is what the Archons want to do. They want to drown us in the oblivion and the zombie consciousness, which is their consciousness, because they want us to be like them. And so it's just exactly like somebody pushing on your shoulders while you're swimming and pushing you underwater. Now I would ask you, if you found yourself in that situation, what would you do to escape the person who was pushing you down?
Well, there'd be many ways you could go about it. You could try to escape. You could pull them down, push back.
What's the most easy and quickest way to escape from someone who would be pushing you down in water to drown you?
Submerge with it and emerge in another place, perhaps.
Go deeper.
Go deeper. Okay.
Go deeper.
Mm-hmm. So, that makes sense.
That's right. What we have to do is we have to go deeper into the electromagnetic field of the Earth to escape the archontic seizure that comes from the planetary system. Go deeper into the embrace of the planetary animal mother. Go into refuge in her embrace. Your refuge is her embrace. And what is her embrace? It's many things, my friends. It's eviscerating tenderness. It's bliss. It's rapture. It's release. It's healing. It's joy like you never imagined. It's the joy of childhood. It's perfect innocence. And it is also, physically speaking, immersion in the electromagnetic iron-bound field of the earth. So you immerse in the iron-bound radiations of the earth. That's what you do to escape this archonic seizure. And one way to do that is to prick your thumb and put it into the ground when you do the Dhyan Tantric vow. Because when you bind with iron to the planetary animal mother, you make yourself available to be immersed more deeply in her telluric currents. The escape from the archons is not an ascension. It's not some luciferic flight from the earth. On the contrary, it's a deeper immersion in the electromagnetic field of the earth. So one way to do that and to counter this archonic influence that comes from behind, this spell-binding seizure, is to do the Dhyan Tantric vow with the ritual of iron bounding. Prick your thumb and allow one tiny drop of your blood to bleed into the earth at the moment that you make your vow, at the moment that you state your intention. And there are other ways to do it as well. I can maybe in the next talk, as we continue, describe a couple of other simple exercises for breaking out of this bat brain seizure that comes from the remote viewing of the archons.
Fantastic. Yeah, let's pick up a little bit more on that in the next talk. And I just have one final very quick question, is if we had the chiral lock released in 319 with one hit, would we be seeing a hit then that would tie into this, that would tie into the archon plexus as well? That would make us be able to deal with it easier?
No, not exactly. There's a different procedure that is leading us out of that seizure of the archons toward absolute freedom, absolute moral freedom, and that is coming in the future surges that I'm going to be plotting, in the crew notes and so forth. So this is an interactive experiment, and we can follow it as it unfolds in real time.
All right, John, well, this has been amazing, and I'm still kind of numb trying to get my mouth to function here. But let's go ahead and call it a day for now, and we will hook up in about 2 days to continue on with talk number 13. And I believe you're actually cut off the line, so I'm going to talk into myself, but that's okay, because we're at the end of the recording time anyway. All right, so I thank you, John, and I thank the listeners. And look forward to the upcoming talk. And with that, good night.